Everyone, it's the Veterinary Voices podcast, and I'm with Rosie Beskerby, who is one of my friends from when I used to work at Bristol Vet School. And you are into dog training specifically, aren't you?
So, yeah, I'm both a dog trainer and a clinical animal behaviourist, where I actually do dogs, cats and rabbits in terms of the behaviour side.
Oh, very good. And so what was your background? Because you did zoology and psychology at university, isn't that right?
Yeah, so I went to Bristol Uni and just chose two subjects that I really enjoyed from A-levels. So with no planned route of career, and did zoology and psychology. And whilst I was at uni, I was kind of desperately researching where this is going to take me in life, and came across a postgraduate course at Southampton Uni in companion animal behaviour counselling. So I didn't even know this kind of job role existed. And back then, there wasn't many people doing what I do. So I thought, well, that's perfect for me. I did go abroad and do a little bit of kind of conservation, wild animal behaviour, helping on sort of PhDs and research projects, but decided I didn't want to spend my life abroad. Although I'm kind of regretting that looking out the window now at the weather. But so I went to Southampton and did the postgraduate diploma there. And the rest is history, as they say.
So your business, do you take mainly referrals from vets, or is it the public coming to you directly, or is it a mixture of both? How does it work?
Yeah, I guess it's a mixture of both these days. I get quite a few inquiries from my social media channels, but yeah, a steady stream of referrals. So I've got a really nice network in Bristol, North Somerset. Loads of, if not all the practices, are really behaviour savvy and behaviour aware, which is really nice. They're pretty switched on and send the referrals out as and when they're needed.
You have to say your Instagram's great. I really find it interesting, the stuff you put on there, especially with your own dogs. Actually, we used to walk your dogs occasionally, didn't we? So how do you find that owner's perception of, firstly, do you do mainly dogs? Is that kind of the majority of your work?
I would say 85% of my load is dogs, yeah.
Yeah. And how much of it is sort of, routine training, like basic training, and how much is actually dealing with behavioural problems and training issues?
So I don't actually offer sort of training classes at all anymore. Haven't for several years. And I actually stopped again several years ago offering one-to-one training, purely because the amount of times I would meet up with the owner and it would transpire that there was way more going on with the dog emotionally than, an initial email inquiry suggested. And, I had to have sort of say, we need a vet referral for this, and this is a bit more complex. We need to sit down and have a good chat. It's a behaviour consult, effectively. Mm. So what I do now is just offer what I call puppy problem prevention sessions. And those are only available for owners of puppies up to about 14 weeks of age. Anything after that is kind of creeping into a more kind of established behavior problem that's got an emotional component, which is how I would kind of distinguish between a, training issue and behavior problem.
I mean, that's a really interesting area, so the puppy problem prevention. As vets, when you're doing routine sort of vaccinations and new puppies and health checks, a lot of the questions you get asked are basically about basic training. I don't always feel like we're equipped to answer those. I haven't got a lot of experience training dogs, certainly not. I grew up on a sheep farm, so the sort of training you give collie dogs to work sheep is very different for a house pet or a new puppy. And so I always struggle. What advice do you have for vets who want to recommend a local dog trainer or behaviourist? What do we need to look for? Because some are better than others, aren't they? And some are actually, downright dangerous.
Well, that's it. I think you've got a couple of things there. One is the importance I feel of getting the right information and advice to puppy owners at that age, rather than trying to blag it. I think, if you're not sure what the latest advice is, what we should be saying, then probably just a bit of honesty. And hopefully there's a nurse or a practice who has got an interest in behaviour and is a bit more puppy and behaviour savvy, and that they can help. Mm. Because I often think that puppies are seen as the easy stage of giving advice, where actually, to me, it's one of the most crucial stages of getting it right, and then people like me wouldn't be needed later on in life. And the other part of that is, if there isn't someone in the practice that can help, or it's going to take too long for someone to give some basic advice, then certainly recommending a local puppy trainer or behaviorist. And that's the issue with our industry, is there is currently no regulation at all. So we do need to be a little bit careful of who we recommend. And one of the concerns to me is the rise in social media, particularly TikTok, and the kind of trainers, self-proclaimed trainers here, that are often on there with huge followings, you know, millions of UK followers, that are giving downright dangerous and very concerning welfare advice and methods.
So one these of the are kind of like the old-fashioned kind of view of dog training, isn't it? Sort of like sometimes it's sort of, you know, how you dominate a dog or be leader of the pack. And it certainly used to be a lot of very popular television programs of famous dog trainers. And now that's sort of moving on to social media. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, that's right. I feel like we've gone full circle a little bit, because it was, yeah, like you said, you know, in the 80s, that was very much the concept based on some research that was done on a captive wolf pack. And then as research moved on and they realized that, you know, the research on a captive wolf pack isn't transferable to the domestic dog in a home environment, we realized that the concept of, you know, a linear hierarchy in domestic dogs is null and void. And that's not the way we need to, therefore, you know, there's no need for us to try and be the alpha or dominate our dogs.
So can you just clarify that, just for people who aren't aware of that kind of research or that kind of training philosophy? It's trying to sort of recreate a wolf pack hierarchy in your home. Is that basically what it comes down to?
Yeah, so the concept was in this group of captive wolves that the alphas used a lot of aggression, such as pinning other wolves down and monopolizing resources, so accessing the food first, etc. So the concept was, in order to maintain harmony in the home, that humans needed to be the alpha and effectively treat our dogs in the same way that those alpha wolves were treating the other pack members. So physically pinning our dogs down to the floor, making sure we ate first, going through doorways first, quite a lot of harsh punishment based and sometimes sort of downright stupid things like, you know, never letting your dog be higher than you, literally. So, you know, don't let them be on stairs because they'll be above you, or don't let them be on the back of the sofa because they'll be above you. And actually, the captive wolf pack that was all based on was a very aggro environment. And they realized not in any way related to how a group of harmonious dogs or a group of wild, you know, a family of wolves in the wild interact at all. And actually, the way those relationships are based is based very much on trying to avoid any aggression at all, because that is not an evolutionary stable strategy when you're a group living social creature.
So that's sort of wild wolf packs don't show as much aggression as this captive wolf pack.
But that's some, right.
And
that's
I guess
right.
The other thing that we often think about this from dog physiology and medicine and nutrition, you know, dogs have been domesticated for, you know, tens of thousands of years, and they're actually very different from wolves anyway, aren't they? You know, they're not sort of tame wolves living in your house. Like they've absolutely changed into different species, really, haven't they?
Well, that in itself and part of that domestication means that dogs are even more appeasing than wolves. You know, they are designed to appease us, and they want harmony in their lives, the same as, you know, the same as we do. And yeah, so going back to the basics, there's absolutely no reason to eat before them unless it's convenient to you, or walk through the door before them again unless you're wanting to teach them manners and not barge through and knock you over. So, you know, more practical based advice. The other thing is, we know through even the captive wolves that there's no linear hierarchy. So what we used to think as the alpha is simply just the breeding pair. And actually, when you look at and study all of the different interactions between familiar dogs or familiar wolves, it's more of a spider web. Once you put across the sort of direction of relationships and who's slightly above another, and it's all dependent on motivation for individual resources, age, strength, fitness, and, you know, what one dog is going to be very motivated to get access to food, another dog is going to be very motivated to get access to its owner or toys. So it's so much more complex. And I think it's, you know, demeaning our dogs to think of them as basic as, you know, yes, to sit on the top of the sofa to dominate you. No, it's probably just comfy and they can see out the window from there.
Yes. So when we're looking for reputable behaviorists or trainers, what sort of, there must be sort of accreditation or organizations that we're good ones belong to. Are there any that you recommend, or what are you part of?
Yeah, so as I said, there isn't any regulation at the moment. There is a body called the Animal Behaviour and Training Council, and that's kind of a good starting point for either vets and nurses to look at themselves and find your local, people, or to post to owners to look themselves. And that consists of a group of organisations, both training and behaviour organisations, who have shown that their assessment criteria ticks various boxes, so that they are assessing both knowledge and understanding and practical components of the level that their organisation provides, and that they've got welfare is important and paramount, and that they've got a good complaints procedure. And then within the Animal Behaviour and Training Council, there will be training organisations, and there'll be organisations that assess for clinical animal behaviourists and those that assess for veterinary behaviourists. So that's a really good place to start. I would say that there are a couple of organisations that, for one reason or another, are not part of the Animal Behaviour and Training Council, whether that's that they're in the process of doing it or for some reason they've chosen not to be. Yeah, but the Animal Behaviour and Training Council is a very good way, good starting place. They've got the Association of Pet Behaviour Counsellors on there, which provides clinical animal behaviourists, veterinary behaviourists, and animal behaviour technicians. I'm a member of them and of various dog training organisations, such as the Association of Pet Dog Trainers and the Professional Association of Canine Trainers, which I'm a member of.
So I was really struck by you said you do puppy prevention problems training when they're under 14 weeks. Could you list a couple of really common examples that we should probably be aware of as vets? What do you commonly see? What sort of prevention and interventions are you getting owners to do at that age?
Gosh, well, I think you get the usual. I'm going to sort of distinguish this between the usual puppy queries like toilet training, because in that moment, that is what owners need help with. Rarely that becomes an issue long term. But then you have the kind of, there's still puppy problems, but if they're not dealt with appropriately or nipped in the bud at that age, it can become a long-term issue, like separation issues. The puppy follows me everywhere, it cries even when I shut the toilet door. We're getting no sleep because the breeder told us to just shut it downstairs in its crate, and it's howling all night, and we've had
I'm glad you
complaints.
brought that up because actually on Vet Voices, we said we'd be interviewing you and said, are there any questions for Rosie from vets and vet nurses about behavior? And one of them was separation anxiety. And someone actually wrote saying that I'd love to hear the latest on separation anxiety because I've heard that maybe it's not best practice anymore just to sort of gradually increase the amount of time you leave a dog alone. I guess starting with puppies, that's really important because you might get separation anxiety in the first place. If you could talk about that first, and then we'll go on to what you do when you have an actual adult dog with separation anxiety.
Sure, it's a great question. So with puppies, what we need to remember is that it's completely normal for a young puppy to want to follow the attachment figure, and that, again, they've come from being with their litter and not being used to being on their own at all for majority of them. So we need to build it up gradually. We shouldn't be flooding them with stress hormones in the brain by forcing them to spend time on their own and working through their distress. And I think it also will have impacts. How we deal with this will impact the owner's relationship with the puppy, because what we're aiming for is for the owner and the puppy to have a secure attachment with each other. And we know through child development that that's very important for the best chance of that individual to grow up happy and healthy and secure in themselves and all the rest of it. So the way we would do that is respond to our puppy when they do show any sort of distress. And I think there's a slight difference here, and something that I like to get across to owners, between a puppy that's got a bit overtired and is having a bit of a whine and a bit of a minor tantrum, shall we say, about the fact it's time for a nap and it's time to settle down, or it's time to, just be over there on your own for a minute, versus a puppy that's actually panicking and distressed about that. So as soon as it sort of moves from whinging, whining, like, oh, I don't want to do this, to I'm really getting stressed now, we must make sure the owner responds. And the easiest thing to do at night time, when puppies first arrive in the home, and often I know vets and vet nurses and me don't get to see them at this stage, but if you do get to speak to anyone before they bring their puppy home, the biggest tip I would give is to sleep next to the puppy initially. And this might seem a bit backwards, because a lot of people think, well, shouldn't we start as we mean to go on? Well, not if the puppy's going to find that stressful. And for some puppies, it might only be a couple of nights. For some puppies, it might be a few weeks. Everyone's individual. And the other thing I should say, if an owner wants the puppy or the dog upstairs in their bedroom with them long term, there's also no problem at all with that. That is an individual preference.
So that doesn't, because there's a bit of a myth that that can create long-term problems. It's not going to be likely to have separation anxiety or issues.
Absolutely no evidence to suggest that's the case at all. And certainly, yeah, I would agree with that it doesn't cause it.
And when you say sleep with them, do you mean like in a crate next to the bed? Do you recommend crating?
Yeah, a crate or just their own bed. A crate is useful because it stops them, toileting on the carpet or going off for wanders. They are happy and relaxed in the crate next to the bed rather than getting distressed in the crate. And then the aim is that the crate or the bed can be sort of moved gradually out of the room and we kind of wean them off rather than, it's all or nothing. Mm. And that should become easier for the puppy once they've settled into their new home. They've established the relationships, they know where they are, they've got the familiar scent profile in the home, as opposed to arriving in this strange place on day one, having been whipped away from all their siblings and then expected to last the whole night alone. And once the puppy's kind of comfortable pottering around the house by themselves, you can pop in and out of a different room and they're happy not needing to follow you. And one of the tips for that is to make sure the puppy has a constant supply of interesting items, I suppose. So things that are self-reinforcing and the puppy can play with independently, food dispensing toys or things to lick at or things to chew on. And they're absorbed in their activity and it doesn't bother them that the owner's popping in and out of the room. That's stage one. And then how long's a piece of string, but a week or so, we can start to leave the house for short periods of time. Yeah. And the person that asked this question, is correct in saying we shouldn't, there's not a recipe for this. So it's not leave them for 1 minute on day one, 2 minutes on day two. It doesn't work like that. We have to make sure it's working at the pace of the individual puppy. And the idea is that we pop out and we pop back before the puppy shows distress.
So you want to be back before they've sort of got themselves wound up?
Yeah, absolutely. Or ideally, before they've even realised you've been gone, And that's the other thing. Young puppies sleep so much and so, so deeply that it's an ideal time to be building up, popping the bins out and, popping out in the garden. And we've got great technology at our fingertips now. You just put your iPad on record or FaceTime yourself. And you can watch your puppy and just check how they're doing when they're home alone. Just reassurance or to know, if you need some help, if the puppy is actually not settled when they're left.
Yeah. So that's been interesting to me. I hadn't realised that if you long term, you're planning on letting your puppy sleep in a different room or downstairs, that it's fine to have it on the first day in your own bedroom with you. And it's actually quite a sensible thing to do. But it's a huge thing, isn't it? I mean, you leave your siblings, your mum, that have been with you your whole life to go somewhere new and then be on your own. A heck of a shock to the system.
Absolutely. I think the other tip then is if you don't want the puppy, having upstairs access long term, is you carry the puppy up and put them straight in the crate and in the morning they're carried straight down. So they're not getting the chance to run around upstairs and find upstairs really fun and learning how to get up and down the stairs. And the other option is owners sometimes choose to put a mattress downstairs. So the puppy is staying where they always will sleep.
And So sleep on the sofa for a bit, if that's it.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a little bit harder to wean yourself out of the room than it is a crate out of the room. So it's just individual preferences.
That's so true. So that's a really good one, actually. You first got the puppy home, and that's good advice we can give to owners if we see them at that stage. I guess one of the questions that they asked in Vet Voices, which was a really good one, is that as a behaviourist, what advice do you hear vets commonly give that you think's either unhelpful or not? Yeah, unhelpful is probably the word I'll use. Are there common things that owners say, the vet told me this, the vet told me that, and you're rolling your eyes, go, why do they keep saying this?
Oh, I don't get that anymore because my referring vets are fab, but I guess
very diplomatic. No vets that you work with ever give this terrible advice, but go on.
I think one of the ones actually would be, leave a puppy to cry, just under no circumstances respond if the puppy's crying. Just put your earplugs in and give your neighbours a bottle of wine and just absolutely do not respond if they're crying. And I think the concern is that if we respond to a puppy crying, the puppy learns that vocalizing gets attention, as it were, and then they won't stop learning to not cry. But if you go back a little bit more than that, we need to work out why the puppy's crying. A puppy isn't going to learn to love or be happy being left on their own that way. They're always going to find it stressful. They just might learn there's no point in calling for help. I hate it still, but what is the point in screaming and shouting? I'll just suffer it in silence. Whereas actually, don't we all want our animals to be chilled and quite happy about being left on their own? So that would be one thing, I guess, said to others. The other, I think some colleagues of mine would say, is that so someone takes their dog into the vet with a behaviour problem and the vet does a clinical check and says, can't find anything medically that's causing or contributing to the behaviour, so I'm happy to refer you to the behaviourist. Most of us work by going out to the owner's houses to see the owner and the dog. And one of the benefits that gives us over the vets in the clinic is that we get to see the dog most relaxed in its own home environment. And one of the advantages of that is we can see the dog moving quite freely, where it's not full of adrenaline and it's not tense and, you know, stiff for the vet to examine. And unless you're a veterinary behaviorist, whilst clinical animal behaviorists are absolutely not vets and we're not, you know, not in any way qualified to diagnose any sort of medical problems, including pain, sometimes it's just quite noticeable, you know, that a dog's moving strangely or limping, you know, something like that. And so in those cases, we would go back to the referring vet and say, I'm a bit suspicious that there's something else going on. And, you know, I'm not sure if the dog's in a bit of discomfort or pain. Would it be possible to do some further investigations or look into that? And again, all of my referring vets, we work brilliantly and it's not a problem. But I think some colleagues struggle with vets who say, well, I couldn't find anything, so I think it is purely behavioural. And the poor client in these instances, or the poor dog as well, is kind of stuck in the middle of this scenario. And I think this, hopefully, I'd like to have a chat about the link between pain and behaviour and medical things and behaviour anyway. But I think in these scenarios, it's important that vets will consider the fact that dogs in the clinic will often hide signs of pain and discomfort.
Yeah. So the client's then left in sort of limbo, where the vet said there's no problem, the behaviorist is saying it's a veterinary problem, and then where do they go next? Yeah. So
that's it. And I think a behaviorist isn't saying it's a veterinary problem and trying to palm them off, but there will be limited progress with a behavior modification program if there is any underlying pain or discomfort. And we know through studies now that there's a huge link between pain and behaviour. A study from Lincoln University and their behaviour department found, I think it's anything between 40 and 85% of cases that they saw had a pain component.
Behavioural cases had a pain component. And can it be as simple, this is a really important issue you talk about here, the link between pain and behaviour. You know, the classic and obvious one is that, you know, if you've got an old dog or any dog with arthritis, it's limping. Owners don't recognize limping as pain and say it's just stiff and just old, it's not pain and that kind of stuff. And that's something we sort of battle with on a daily basis, trying to educate and engage with people on that. But does it actually, can it lead to behavioral problems if a dog is in pain? Like, do you mean things like just snapping at the owner because it's grumpy, or can it be a lot more significant than that?
Yeah, so there's various reasons that pain contributes to, you know, undesirable behavior. One is when a dog's got, you know, pain or discomfort, they are going to be a bit clingier to their attachment figure. So that can lead to, you know, contributing to separation issues, a bit like a young child, you know, when you're feeling under the weather, you just walk in arm, don't you? That's one way. One is that it reduces an animal's tolerance for things that they might otherwise tolerate. So again, if you've ever got a banging headache, or certainly again for me, I can only give you things that I can relate to. If I've got a banging headache and the kids are running riot at home, I'm much more likely to be a bit sleepy with them than if I don't have a headache. And the third reason is that if dogs are painful in any area, then they're going to be using strategies to get things that are perceived threat that's going to contribute to or cause the pain. So things like handling, touch, startle reflexes will trigger the pain response in them. So that can lead to sensitivity to noises like fireworks. So if they, you know, if they suddenly startle to a firework, that's going to trigger a potential pain response. Mm. So yeah, and I mean, it's more than just the orthopedic pain. Obviously, like you said, that is the obvious, but even things like dermatological problems, gastro problems, you know, all of these things just have a huge link between reducing the animal's tolerance for coping. And, you know, it, again, it's a, each individual kind of medical component has various reasons why it affects behavior, but overall, any medical issue is going to reduce an animal's tolerance for coping with things they might otherwise. And one of the rules we say is if it's a sudden change in behavior, sudden onset, 99.9% of the time it's a medical issue or component causing that.
Yeah, so we see that in a lot of animals, don't we? I mean, a lot of people don't recognize, you know, horses with gastric ulcers is a really classic example. It's very painful. They've turned grumpy. They no longer like being tacked up. And, you know, there's some people who think that, you know, the horse needs a bit more discipline or, and actually you think, well, if it's a sudden change and it never used to be like that, then there's probably something going on, isn't it? It'll be the same with dogs. Yeah. So this has been really interesting and I can see how we could do hours on this. So we should, and I'd love to do one on cats and rabbits as well, because I think, that they're fascinating animals, aren't they? Because they're completely, especially cats and dogs, they're, you know, the way they relate to other animals and other people in their vicinity is their brains are completely differently wired up, aren't they? So that must be a very interesting part of your work.
I'd love to, love to come back and talk about cats and rabbits because, like I said, it's not, they aren't the bulk of my workload, but they are, fascinating creatures and, again, quite misunderstood a lot of the time, so.
Yeah, very good. Well, we will share your website and Instagram and we will feedback any questions that people have as a result of this, but we'd love to have you on again and talk about more about dogs and cats and rabbits and behavior, because I think it is something that we all have to deal with every day in the clinic and we often don't feel equipped to deal with it as well as we should be. So thank you for your time, Rosie. We really appreciate it.
No worries, thank you so much for having me.